1908 was the year. Carl Benz had introduced the first road automobile to use an internal combustion engine much earlier in 1885, but it was in 1908 that the first Model T Ford rolled off an assembly line in Highland Park, Michigan. It was also in 1908 on the streets of New York City that the number of automobiles surpassed the number of horses for the first time. After that, the transformation was so swift as to cause whiplash. Think about this. Horses had been the primary means of transportation since the year 3000 BC. And all of that changed in a heartbeat. Almost immediately after the ascendancy of the car, automated taxicabs followed. And the taxi medallion, that iconic license to operate a cab, became, for most of the 20th century, an investment as rock solid as gold. A dozen years ago in San Francisco, taxi medallions sold for $250,000. In New York City at the same time, they sold for upwards of $1 million. As recently as 2006, New York City taxi medallions were advertised with this tagline, quote, "In New York, the capital of world finance, the hottest investment isn't stocks, bonds, commodities, or even Manhattan apartments. It's taxi medallions. The metal plates affixed to the hoods of this city's 12,779 yellow cabs." Entrepreneurs and family patriarchs alike would invest in a taxi medallion as the safest of bets. And then in 2009, Garrett Camp and Travis Kalanick launched a little company called Uber, through which one could summon a complete stranger through a smartphone, which was itself a new thing, and take a ride in his Toyota Corolla. A decade later, according to Forbes magazine, a decade later, Uber and Lyft together control 70% of the business traveler market in the United States, while the taxi industry controls 6%. And yes, you heard those percentages correctly. New York City taxi medallions have lost 85% of their value. They have crashed faster than tulips in 17th century Holland. Those of you who didn't chuckle need to Google that when you go home. Harvard University business professor Clay Christensen coined the term for such phenomena, disruptive innovation. Initially, in its nascent moments, such an innovation is received by people as novel or even whimsical. People see it as intriguing, but they don't detect the portent that the innovation may redefine their entire lives. Think about those old grainy photos you've seen of the very first automobile drivers in those goggles and gloves, smiling blithely as they pass horse-drawn buggies on dirt roads. But then, as the full impact of the innovation slowly dawns, light-hearted infatuation gives way to wary apprehension, followed by startled anger and fear as the full implications of what's occurring settle in. Life is disrupted. The world is changed. What was thought to be reliable and valuable suddenly doesn't seem so. Nothing can ever be the same again. And there is no going back. This morning's gospel passage, some of you will have noticed, follows immediately upon last week's gospel passage. In fact, today's reading repeats the final line from last week in order to underscore that connection. So last week, Jesus arrived home in Nazareth. There, Jesus went to the synagogue and he read from Isaiah 61, which says this: "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." So in today's gospel, the good people of Nazareth who've been sitting in that synagogue react. At first, Jesus' performance seems novel, even a little whimsical. Here's the son of Joseph the carpenter who left months, maybe years before, on a harebrained journey to follow his crazy cousin John. And now he's come home and he's taken the place of a teacher in the synagogue. And to his fellow Nazarene surprise, Jesus recites well. Jesus' neighbors and kin are casually intrigued. Words previously reached Nazareth about the remarkable acts Jesus has been performing around other towns along the coast of the Sea of Galilee. And the people of Nazareth hope that Jesus perhaps will offer them a parlor trick or two also. Some may even imagine that he'll set up shop now that he's home, draw a little more business to their tiny town. Life will go on as usual, except that Jesus will add just a little dash of innovation to their mundane lives. But Jesus keeps talking. He's not a sideshow, he tells them. He's a prophet, and more than a prophet. And he has not come to tweak their town and add a little bit of spice to their lives. Jesus has come to disrupt their lives, to change their world. He's come to claim Isaiah's future-oriented prophecy as his own present mission. They've all been blind, Jesus tells them. But his good news will give them new sight. What they had thought was valuable in the world isn't really so. They'll come to value what God values. They'll come to love what God loves. Now that Jesus is there, nothing will be the same again, and there is no going back. Well, for the neighbors and kin of Jesus, the full impact of what they're hearing slowly begins to dawn. Casual infatuation shifts to wary apprehension, and then that morphs quickly into seething rage. The good people of Nazareth don't want their world disrupted. And so, Luke tells us this morning, they physically manhandle Jesus south of town to a precipice, and they prepare to throw him off the cliff. But here's the thing. You can't kill disruptive innovation that way. Try as they might, the taxi lobby, city after city, has not slowed Uber and Lyft down. And I suspect that the horse and buggy cabal probably sought to stop the automobile, but to no avail. When one stands at the precipice of a value-altering disruption, a world-changing innovation, rage and bluster may grant momentary satisfaction, but they don't do anything to stem the tide. One can check out and leave the grid entirely, or one can align one's life with the new reality. Those are the only options. Now, granted, when we're talking about disruptive innovation in technology and economics, the social results, especially in the short term, are a mixed bag. Real people experience real distress. As that Harvard professor, Clay Christensen, says bluntly, it hurts to be disrupted. The pain is no less real when our lives are disrupted by the gospel. But then it's the pain of shedding things that are not God's good for us. It's the pain of giving up commitments that are not in keeping with Jesus' vision from Isaiah. It's the pain that is a necessary part of healing our spiritual wounds. The pain of gospel disruption, individual and social, is always good news. See, we're the Nazarenes. We hear the words of Jesus, and we are casually infatuated. We enjoy the aesthetics of worship. We like that when we are low, Jesus buoys us up. But Jesus is about more than that. He's a prophet. And more than a prophet. Jesus is God incarnate. And especially in this Epiphany season, He bestows upon us new eyes to see this world completely differently. He redefines what is valuable in this world and in a life. He shows us what to love and how to love. And now that He is here in this space, now that Jesus has entered into our lives, He won't leave. He is the cosmic disruptive innovation through whom God is remaking the world. And it turns out that it's us and not Jesus who stand at a precipice. Will we go off the grid and pretend that nothing has changed? Or will we, blessedly, realign our cares, our loves, our lives to His new reality? It hurts to be disrupted, but it is also the way to new life, and that abundantly.